This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Sam Cantor, and I'm joined today by General David Petraeus, who, along with Andrew Roberts, is co-author of the recent book Conflict, The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine. The book covers some of the most significant military campaigns of the last 75 years, offering both a critical analysis of this history and insights into the changing character of warfare as we understand it today. There's a lot of material to cover, so General Petraeus, thank you for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Sam. Thanks.
So let's start with the most basic question, which is why did you and Andrew Roberts decide to write this book? And I'm curious, why decide upon 1945 as an appropriate start date for your analysis?
Well, it seemed like a logical place to begin, given that it's the end of World War II, and you have a whole set of new dynamics that will lead to these future conflicts, but also a dynamic that has, so far at least, prevented another world war of the type of those at World War I or World War II. And Andrew rang me after the Russians invaded Ukraine, and he said, you know, there should be a book that provides the military historical context for this, not just the political context. And he rightly observed that there really was not a book that did this. And he asked if I'd like to write it with him. And I jumped at the chance. I've been looking for an opportunity to try to capture the history of the two wars which I was privileged to command, Iraq and Afghanistan, and then also to revisit the Vietnam War, which was the subject of my PhD dissertation at Princeton, but many, many decades back. It was literally at the 10-year mark after the end of that particular American war. We then divvied it up in various ways. We added in the very beginning a very important intellectual construct on strategic leadership, something that I developed as a three-star in the one tour, one command that I had of six that was not in combat, and then employed it beginning with the surge in Iraq and then subsequently at Central Command in Afghanistan and the CIA. He's a delightful guy. He is a tremendous historian and biographer, prodigious work ethic. We've done a lot together before on stage in a variety of different ways in New York, London, and elsewhere. And so it seemed like a great opportunity, and I was really pleased to be able to pursue it with him.
Great. So if we could, let's just take a look at a couple of cases chronologically, and I want to start with the decade or so after World War II. It seems, based on some of the conflicts you describe in the book, that this idea of a total victory like 1945 starts to become elusive. And we should note that this spans both localized conflicts, such as the French in Algeria or Indochina, and more conventional wars like in Korea. So why does this idea of victory seem to slip away from Western militaries?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily did slip away, Sam. If you think about it, I mean, the French clearly lost in Indochina. They lost in Algeria. The Americans in the Gulf War with a huge coalition won in terms of liberating Kuwait. But yes, there were wars such as Korea, where the ultimate outcome was a sort of a frozen conflict, if you will. There's never been an official end of the war. It's just where the front lines are in some agreements back and forth, some tacit, some actual. But many of these wars, I think, did have a fairly conclusive outcome. If you look at Malaysia, for example, as we recount, Oman, a number of these, even some of the irregular wars, which were so devilishly difficult, again, there were those outcomes. So I think it is really more the context and the fact that in some cases you have looming over a particular conflict, the specter of nuclear war, such as was the case in Korea beginning there, and then also the Cold War and so forth.
And you did aptly note that the Gulf War certainly ended what appeared at the time to be a total victory. And I want to, if we could, discuss some of the conflicts of that era. Perhaps beginning with Panama in 1989, Gulf War in 91, and then the conflicts in Serbia. I guess both from a historical perspective and then your own recollections as an officer serving at the time, what type of lessons was the United States military specifically drawing from these conflicts that seemed to be relatively quick, very efficient, involving lower quantities of forces in the past, et cetera?
Well, of course, a war that wasn't mentioned was the Yom Kippur War, which had, for a moment, almost an existential threat to Israel under attack on all sides, but then brilliantly counterattacked and actually were literally on the road to Cairo when that particular war was halted. And that was the most studied war by America, certainly in the post-World War II period. Out of that came a lot of lessons about anti-tank guided missiles, about anti-aircraft systems, about what tanks had to have, and infantry fighting vehicles. And eventually, the U.S. Army in particular, but also the other services, developed these new systems that would be deployed in the Gulf War in particular, a war that was almost sent from Central Casting for the United States Army, given that it trains in the Mojave Desert. It was a war. There's no civilians on the battlefield, with the exception of some of the liberation of Kuwait City. It was essentially tank on tank out in the open, with the U.S. having complete air supremacy and able to pound the Iraqi forces for over 40 days before launching the ground offensive that was complete within 100 hours with very low casualties on the U.S. side. Ideally, you know, we'd love to have that kind of war, but most potential adversaries around the world recognize that the one thing you don't want to do is stand up against the United States, especially if you don't have air parity at the least, out in the open with no civilians, no urban settings, and all the rest of this. And of course, most of our wars since then have had that mix in some fashion. Certainly Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, such as that deployment was, and so forth. Panama was interesting in that this was also an outgrowth of decades of the rebuilding of the U.S. Army in the wake of Vietnam, which, of course, very largely dismantled the non-commissioned officer corps. It was a drafty army in Vietnam, and now this becomes a professional army. It evolves from the hollow army of the 1970s into this very well-trained, well-equipped professional force. They could carry out a very complex operation in Panama, admittedly not against the most high-level enemy threat, but a very very seriously challenging set of operations with airborne operations by the Rangers and the 82nd Airborne Division, air land by 7th Infantry Division, and so forth and so on, with a lot of special mission unit employment in there as well, all orchestrated very, very impressively. So that was the first real example of how far the U.S. Army had come, again, admittedly against not exactly a peer competitor. And then the following year, Operations Desert Shield, which, of course, was the deployment very rapidly of forces to Saudi Arabia to prevent the Iraqis from continuing into the oil fields of the kingdom. And then the conduct of Desert Storm in a very impressive manner.
And you did note the linkages, of course, between the 1973 Yom Kippur War and some of the lessons that specifically the United States military establishment drew from them in developing doctrine over the ensuing two decades. But just before we move into the post-9/11 conflicts, did you have a sense at the time that the officer corps, the wider defense establishment in the United States was perhaps resting on its laurels a little bit from these conflicts, or was there still drivers from various places to ensure that the military power of the United States did not grow stagnant in victory?
I think it was very much the latter, in part, again, particularly in the U.S. Army, Marine Corps as well. Of course, these are our ground forces. There is this combat training center rotation that every brigade commander goes through with his brigade during the course of a two-year command tour, for which there's a lot of practice and training and so forth. Very demanding against another force with highly integrated laser engagement and various impressive simulators for everything that would be on the battlefield. And so, you know, you could feel good. Okay, you know, this is the force that beat the Iraqis, but you go out to the National Training Center and that opposing force was the best fighting force in the world. They also knew every nook and cranny of this vast area of the Mojave Desert at Fort Irwin, where these exercises were conducted. And you would have an after-action review after every battle there, and you didn't often win battles there. I went there as a light air assault battalion commander attached to a heavy brigade, and it's a tough place. We finally did pull it all together in some of the final missions, but you get you know, your backside handed to you pretty regularly out there, and you go into this. They put a shelter out in the desert somewhere, like a huge expando van, and you go in and get a cup of coffee and sit for hours as you go back through the operation that you just conducted, the exercise, and identify where things went well, where things didn't go well. And frankly, the more open you are, the more self-critical you are, the more you learn. And that's literally embedded in the culture of the U.S. Army, the after-action review process. You do after-action reviews, again, after combat operations as well, of course. Always trying to learn, always trying to foster a culture of learning in units, and also trying to foster a culture in which individuals can raise their hand and respectfully push back against something that a commander might think would be wise, intellectually challenge it and so forth. In fact, when I was commanding in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I typically brought folks with me that I knew that had a reputation for politely, respectfully, but firmly pushing back against their commanders. H.R. McMaster was in both of those when I was a four-star, and very, very impressive individual all the way from when I first started mentoring him when he was a captain, and he published his book, Dereliction of Duty, which was his assessment of the performance of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during Vietnam.
Well, you've set up our next question nicely. So let's discuss a little bit the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I want to note at the outset, so the introduction to the book said you and Andrew Roberts focus solely on the conflicts that contributed to the evolution of warfare. And within that context, I found it very fascinating that I think it was almost a quarter of the page count was devoted to Iraq and Afghanistan. So I suppose the question is, beyond just the implications that these conflicts had for the United States and the United States military, what were some of the implications they had for the overall trends in the evolution of warfare? And that could be for Western militaries or for adversaries observing the actions we took in those conflicts.
Well, obviously, these were what would be termed irregular wars. And in each case, the only possible approach, we had some policymakers that thought you didn't have to necessarily do all this, but the only possible approach to achieving your objectives was to design and then implement a comprehensive civil-military counterinsurgency campaign. And frankly, we had to relearn a lot of that. We made a lot of mistakes in the early years in both countries. And so we had to really relearn all of this. We didn't even have a doctrinal manual until we wrote it when I was in that 1-3-star job between the 3- and 4-star tours in Iraq. This also, though, is a great vehicle for illustrating the tasks of a strategic leader that I mentioned earlier that were laid out in the introduction to the book. There are four in number. You have to get the big ideas right. You have to get the strategy right by understanding in very detailed manner the your forces, the enemy forces, the human terrain in the area, the physical terrain, how a country operates, how it's supposed to run, to work, all of the different segments of society, the ethnic, sectarian, political, and other groupings, the neighborhood, all of this, and then craft the right strategy, get the big ideas right. You then have to communicate the big ideas effectively through the breadth and depth of the organization and to everyone else who has a stake in the outcome of the conflict. That's task number two. Task number three for the strategic leader, and this is the leader at the very top, so it is the commander of the multinational force in Iraq or the commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. Third task is that the strategic leader has to oversee the implementation of the big ideas. This is the organizational architecture that you design. They're all different because every conflict is different. It's attracting and retaining the best and brightest people that you can get your hands on, taking care of them. It's allowing those not measuring up to move on to something else. It's the metrics that you use. And I highlight, for example, that in Vietnam, the body count was the wrong method, the wrong metric, in part because it was linked to the wrong strategy. All the way, we wasted 13 years in Vietnam before we finally got the right strategy, the right big ideas, which was essentially a comprehensive civil military counterinsurgency campaign, having opted in the earlier years for essentially a war of attrition against an enemy who couldn't be defeated in that way, and focusing on big unit operations and body count with often indiscriminate use of force, et cetera. And again, it was not until late 1968 with General Abrams that we finally actually crafted the right strategy, but by then we'd really squandered far too long. And ultimately, of course, had to negotiate a withdrawal. That was a war that was not sustainable. So you got to get the right metrics. We drilled those very hard when I was a commander in Iraq during the surge. You also have to have the right battle rhythm. The way you drive the implementation of a strategy of the big ideas is the meetings that you have, the frequency, what's covered, what are the topics, all the rest of this. And again, what are the metrics that show you whether you're making progress or falling back in each of the areas that is important in the campaign. And on that battle rhythm, you have to have events that help you foster a culture of learning. And the fourth task is indeed to identify how you need to refine the big ideas, the changes you need to make to the strategy as the context evolves, as you make progress or experience setbacks. And this is done again with a series of meetings. For example, once a month, I'd meet with the full colonels that were the heads of the different lessons learned teams of the Army, Marine Corps, Joint Forces, Special Ops Forces, our Counterinsurgency Center, et cetera. We had weekly meetings with the strategic planners who would force me to make decisions so that 6 months from then we'd be in the place that we wanted to be and make adjustments to the strategy and on and on. But also, again, constantly reinforcing that this is a culture of learning. So if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, in both cases, pretty impressive campaign to topple the existing regime. In Afghanistan, that was the Taliban because they refused to bring al-Qaeda to justice in the wake of the 9/11 attacks that were planned in sanctuary that al-Qaeda had in eastern Afghanistan under Taliban rule. So again, quite an impressive early campaign, but we then quickly took our eye off the ball, and it was not for 9 years in Afghanistan that we actually finally had all of the inputs right. So not just the right big ideas, the right strategy, but also almost the right level of forces, right levels of diplomats, spies, development workers, rule of law experts, financial forensics, you name it, all the different experts that you need, the right organizational architecture, the right preparation of our forces, which is very important as well, the right leaders, and so forth. 9 years. In fact, I happened to be the commander by then, having taken over from General McChrystal, who did the most to get that strategy right and to set us on that path so that we could achieve what we did about halfway through my time in Afghanistan in late 2010. But unfortunately, we didn't keep the inputs right for more than about 6 months. We started drawing down before the conditions really warranted that. Certainly, the subsequent drawdowns often were not warranted. In Iraq, again, pretty impressive campaign. I was a two-star general, part of the invasion there, commanding the great 101st Airborne Division, flight to Baghdad, toppling the regime, pretty extraordinary. But we then implemented some very bad big ideas because we really hadn't thought through the so-called phase four, the post-conflict phase. This is the phase that would have civilians starting to take over. We'd still be there to maintain security and so forth. But the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was very much a pickup team, which followed the Organization for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, whose leaders were shuffled off the stage by Secretary Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense of the U.S. at the time, when he was displeased with how they were doing. And an individual came in who had very little understanding of Iraq, and the first two orders were catastrophically bad. Firing the Iraqi military, the entire military, without telling them how we're going to enable them to provide for their family. This violates one of the really big rules, which is that you should never conduct an operation or implement a policy that creates more bad guys than it takes off the street by its conduct. And this rendered hundreds of thousands of young Iraqi men with military training and weapons to a position of their incentive being to oppose the new Iraq rather than to support it. And we never really were able to fix that. It took five long weeks before we implemented a stipend program and so forth. We could have actually used those forces. What we should have done is carry out a DDR process, a disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration program, in which we explicitly laid out how we would enable them to continue to take care of their families as they sought new employment. Then compounded that by firing the Ba'ath Party all the way down to level four, which included tens of thousands of bureaucrats, many of them Western educated and many of them relatively secular, who we needed to run a country that we really didn't fully understand. We didn't have the in-depth knowledge and appreciation of the country. Although, frankly, a lot of us had really gotten on with things and had the situation in quite a good position prior to this. In Mosul, in the northern part of Iraq, where the 101st ultimately ended up, for example, we already had a provisional provincial council. We had a provisional governor. We were running direct elections in the districts, the sub-province level, doing numerous small projects and so forth, getting people back to work, reopened the border, refurbished the irrigation system, and on and on. And then this sort of cut us off at the knees for a period until we were able, and at least in our case, we had a special exception from Ambassador Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, in Nainoa Province, the capital, which is Mosul, to do essentially a reconciliation process with those that had been fired. And we did that with tens of thousands, ultimately, and got them back. The problem was that our process was not validated by those in Baghdad after we left, and that led to the challenges that area experienced following our departure early the next year. So again, you had to get the big ideas right, and it took us some years. Then eventually an embassy was put in. We should have had that from the beginning instead of this ad hoc rotational group that was in Baghdad, which also was ruling the country like a proconsul or vice consul or what have you. Then we got it together. It's going pretty well in Iraq. We've got a train and equip mission going on. That was my 3-star tour. General Casey gets the right organizational architecture. We generally have a comprehensive civil military counterinsurgency campaign until early in 2006, when a terrible event, a Sunni extremist bombing of a Shia shrine in a Sunni-predominant area, set off a cycle of sectarian violence that plunged the country eventually, in many areas, into a full-blown Sunni-Shia civil war. And that necessitated a reversal of what was by then being done, which was pulling our forces out of the neighborhoods, preparing to draw down and go home, and handing off to the Iraqis. We had to reverse all of that 180 degrees during the surge, when we very much got the big ideas right and the execution and all the rest. Witness that the key metric, essentially significant activities, violence indicators, was down by nearly 90% during the conduct of the 18 months of the surge, which we did effectively draw down at the end of that 18-month period, and then had an orderly drawdown over the subsequent years until our final forces left in late 2011, only to have the prime minister of that country set off another cycle of sectarian violence by some policies that he pursued, which included attempting to arrest the senior Sunni Arab political figure, the vice president, also the minister of finance, also a prominent parliamentarian from Anbar province, a Sunni predominant province. And that allowed the Islamic State, the outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which we destroyed during the surge, to get back on its feet, go into Syria, generate considerable additional power, and sweep back into Iraq and establish the first ever Islamist extremist caliphate in history, or at least in modern history, in northern Iraq with Mosul as its capital, and then in northeastern Syria with Raqqa as the capital there. So this sort of traces for you, and again, so much of this comes back to getting the big ideas right, and of course, communicating them effectively, then overseeing their implementation and determining how you refine them to do it again and again and again. So it's a very, you just continue the process. And part of that comes back once more to learning. And in the counterinsurgency field manual, which we drafted during the 15 months that I was back in the States, we highlight that the side that learns the fastest in such conflicts typically prevails. We're seeing some of that, by the way, in Ukraine now. The Russians did not seem to learn in the first year or more, but by the time of the summer counteroffensive last year, all of a sudden there was a realization that they had established a very, very formidable defense into which the forces were attacking. So very, very substantial minefields, trenches, wire, and drones on top of all of it, making it very difficult to conduct breaches of these very formidable minefields and obstacles because Russian artillery was hammering them as they were doing it. So they had to adjust and really didn't achieve what they'd hoped would be the case. More recently, the Russians, I was just in Ukraine this past week, in fact, making use of glide bombs, using Iranian-made drones, massive quantities of artillery that right now they're shooting 7 rounds for every 1 round the Ukrainians are able to shoot, in part because the U.S. Needs to resume its assistance. It really has dwindled very considerably during the 6 months that Congress has wrangled with this issue. But again, both sides are learning, but you have a context here where one side has more than 3 times the population, Russia compared with Ukraine, and more than 10 times the economy. On the other side, you see the Ukrainians very impressively using maritime drones and air drones to sink about 30% of the Black Sea fleet of Russia, and basically to push them out of the western part of the Black Sea, including forcing them to withdraw from a port they've occupied for centuries, that of Sevastopol on the west side of the Crimean Peninsula, thereby allowing the Ukrainians to export wheat, grains, some minerals, and so forth through the western Black Sea. And it's a huge shot in the arm for them economically. But it's difficult right now for Ukraine. And each side is grappling with how to generate additional forces. Russia, again, seems to have a major advantage here. And again, to adapt in an era where each side is using increasingly unmanned systems, some of them remotely piloted, some increasingly algorithmically piloted, but systems on the ground as well, automatic machine guns or remotely piloted machine guns, in addition to suicide drones, first-person view drones, higher-flying intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, all trying to, particularly on the Ukrainian side, reduce the losses, given the challenges that they have in terms of a much smaller population and generating additional forces now 2 years into this war.
And your insights into Ukraine, I think, set us up nicely for this last question, which is, in reading the book, I at least came away with the sense of the importance, perhaps, of people over hardware, whether the human geography that you described or the role of strategic leaders, even inherent in the title, right? Conflict implies something deeply human in a way that perhaps the industrialized visions of warfare do not. So just broadly, amidst the proliferation of some of the automated military tools that you just described, how do you see the role of people, of the individual going forward into conflicts with the future?
Well, it's absolutely the most important element, although as always, you want to have the people enabled by and employing the very best hardware, equipment, software, systems, and so forth. But as I've sought to emphasize, the single biggest element, we believe, that should come out through the book in these different conflicts is that element of strategic leadership. If you don't get the big ideas right up front, and Russia did not for quite a while in Ukraine. Keep in mind that the Ukrainians retook about half of the territory that the Russians had seized in the early months of the war. They had to withdraw completely from Kyiv, from Kharkiv, from Sumy, Chernihiv, and so forth. But over time, they first established that very formidable defense in the south that the Ukrainians couldn't get fully through. They got through one defensive belt, probably two more lay between them and their desire to shut off the ability to go on the ground across southeastern Ukraine and hook into Crimea from the north. And then the Russian adaptation with especially glide bombs that they could launch as much as 70 kilometers behind the front lines, because neither side is really using what we would know as close air support right over top of the troops. The air defense systems are just too lethal for that. And they typically use drones and a variety of other systems. But these are very substantial bombs, and they can just hammer in the massive use of artillery that Russia can do. It's gotten over 1 billion rounds of artillery ammunition from North Korea to augment what it had. It has very substantial stocks of old tanks, so they're not the newest, but they do have a quality because of their quantity as well. So once again, strategic leadership is the biggest element, we believe. But as I think it was Stalin who said something along the lines of quantity having a quality of its own. And in this context, Russia has that. They also have a seemingly lack of concern for casualties, which are horrific on their side, expending enormous quantities of soldiers for incremental gains, but they do continue to accumulate those gains. And if the U.S. assistance isn't quickly approved and into the pipeline and so forth, this could be a fraught period for Ukraine. If it does arrive, if Ukraine is able, now having made changes in its conscription law and mobilization and so forth, if they can generate the additional forces, then I think they can certainly maintain what they have. But there won't be a prospect of the kind of hopes for a counteroffensive that were present last year in the late spring. It's a much more sober picture now.
And as we look at how that conflict develops, I'm sure a book like yours can help really frame the way that we study and analyze such conflicts.
We're just doing the second edition right now. I just reviewed the latest changes, or it really additions to that chapter. And then we also are adding a chapter on Gaza, which is another very interesting conflict, obviously still very much ongoing. But one can ask whether or not the big ideas have been appropriate for this.
Well, we look forward to the next edition. General Petraeus, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be with you.
The book, once again, is Conflict, the Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine. The authors are General David Petraeus and Andrew Roberts. For New Books Network, I'm Sam Cantor, and we'll see you next time.